our speaker tonight. I got to know our speaker when I first was getting sober. I was unemployed for a few years, and I was able to attend the noon meetings here, and I was able to see this guy all the time. And I always liked what he had to say. And you came here to hear him and not me, as usual. So without further ado, here's UW.
I'm an alcoholic. My name is GW.
I
am sober today through the grace of God and AA. The one big difference between animals and Homo sapiens is that animals don't get awed all the time. Humans have the ability to be awed, maybe at a sunset at the beach or a fire or something. We're just awed from inside out. And I don't know about you, but my sobriety date's May the 4th, 1977, and the 36 years of sobriety awes the hell out of me. Because I didn't want to be here when I got here. I just didn't want to be here. I joined the Navy when I was 17. I just found out last year my mom passed in September, and around January, February, she started to clear out all of her conscious stuff. And I learned when I had my first drink. She said, "You were about 6 months old." I was in Boston, Massachusetts. That's where I was born. It was wintertime. You were 6 months old. You had scarlet fever, and you couldn't hold anything down. The doctors didn't know what to do. And my mom told me my father took a tablespoon and warmed it and put beer in it and fed it to me, and I held it down. So, yeah, good Irishman. Great. But that was my first drink of alcohol. And my father passed when I was 10. And my mother loved alcoholic men. She married and buried seven before she died. And I didn't have a liking to any of them. I joined the Navy when I was 17. The way I got into the Navy is stepfather number three, I think, number two or three, I can't remember. But showed up, and when I got off the school bus, I was 17 years old, I got off the school bus, and he had taken a hammer and broken all the windows because the air conditioning was broken. He was drunk. And I walked in the house, and he said, "If you give me any crap, I'll beat the shit out of you." And I says, "Well, pack a lunch. It's going to be an all-day job." So he came out in the front yard. I took an axe handle and clicked him in the knee and put him on the ground. And I was all that rage and frustration was coming out of me, and I was just pounding him. And the neighbors saw it and called the police. My mom came up behind me with an iron frying pan and clocked me in the head. And I was arrested for assault. And that was in 1965. And I was standing in the courtroom, and the judge says, "Well, you can either go..." This is in Lake County. I grew up in Leesburg. But the judge says, "You can either go to the Willis McCall's Boys Ranch," which is basically slave labor, "or you can see this guy in this white uniform." And I just looked at him and I said, "Can you get me out of here?" He said, "Oh, yeah." So my mom had to sign off on me because I was 17. I had to be 18 or have the parent's signature to go. And she said, "What if I don't sign it?" I says, "Well, if you don't sign it, you won't know where I am. If you do sign it, you'll know where I am. But I'm not staying. I'm out of here." So she signed off on it, and I joined the Navy. And my first year in the Navy, I learned how to drink. And that was 1965 when I joined the Navy. And they hadn't discovered nylon yet back in 1965. What they used was these Sensimillion hemp ropes about 5 inches in diameter to tie up the ships. And I'm one of the guys that caught the phrase smoking rope. You ever heard that?
Mm-hmm.
That's what we did. We'd take a chunk of it and go up in a paint locker with a flame and light that thing up and get it smoking and fill the whole room with smoke and just get stoned to the bejesus, and they couldn't figure it out. So when I was out at sea, I was stoned on the rope, and when I was in port, I never made it past the first bar, ever. All I wanted to do was get drunk. And when I turned 18, I went to Vietnam, 18 years old, And they were looking for warm bodies. And so I went over to Vietnam, and I was in country for 3 years because I liked doing what I was doing, which was crazy. And my first enlistment had run out, four-year enlistment. So I came back here, and the best job I could get when I got out of the Navy was extruding plastic for the wall things along the wall here, you know, and a big machine and all. And I had the midnight shift, and all I'd do is stand in front of this machine and dump wax into this hopper, and I had a caliber that I'd check the thickness of it, you know, and every once in a while, just for shits and giggles, I'd go and make them that thick, and then I'd make them that thick. And they'd ship them out to the stores, you know, so you never know. If you got a piece of plastic molding for your nose that thick, it was me. But I got the Navy contacted me, and they said they'd give me a $10,000 bonus if I reenlisted. And they'd give me 30 days. I went, done deal. So I reenlisted for four more years. Or was it six? I think it was six. 6 years. And they gave me $10,000, and by the time I reported to the duty station, I was broke. Because I drank a lot. And I used any... I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous, but I used any substance I could find to change my feelings and my emotions and my behavior. I used to take Black Beauties to quicken hangover. You know, they worked perfect. I was a great acid freak. I did that for about, socially for about 5 years. Like once every 3 days, I was getting peeping on the other side, you know, doing crazy stuff. And my mom, she was on this diet fad. She said, "I got something for you," and she'd go get me some of her, Black Beauties and pain pills and shit, you know, to kind of calm me. So I'm anything I could find that would change my emotional or mental outlook, I used. So I was in the Navy, and I was getting ready to get out. I had 10 years, and I'm getting ready to get out of the Navy. And I go up down to the personnel office, and I said, "I'm here to get my checkout sheet. I'm ready to go." And they showed a picture to me of me standing in the forecastle with a black ensign, raising my hand and re-enlisting. And I did it in a blackout. I have to this day no idea who he was or what we were doing. I just had a picture of me with my hand on him swearing it out. So. And that was for 6 years. So that would be like 16 years, 15 years in the Navy. And after 2 years of that reenlistment, the CO of the ship that I was on came to me and said this. He said, "If you have one more alcohol-related incident, we are going to give you a bad conduct discharge and throw your ass out of here." And by this time, the Navy was all I knew. So I stayed. And I said, "I'll go to AA and not drink until I retire." So I came here. And I didn't come here because I wanted to stop drinking. I didn't come here because I wanted to find God. I didn't come here because I wanted to help anybody. I came here because I had a flamethrower up my ass, and I wanted to put it out and put those people to sleep so they'd leave me alone. So I'd stay sober for 30 days, then go back out and drink. And you know, when I had long weekends, and I'd show up sober at the ship, you know, I was sneak drinking and watching my intake. I knew when I could drink and black out, and I knew when I couldn't. And I figured what the Navy tells you that you're drinking too much, you must be drinking too much. Because that's all we did back in those days. We didn't have cell phones or internet or anything. You know, we for enjoyment, we had whiskey and lots of it. So my first 5 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd just show up and I'd chase the girls. And my first home group was kind of interesting. I went to a meeting clubhouse like this. There's a Revo's club up in Virginia Beach. And I went to this meeting, and they said, I'm looking for a home group, is what I told the guy that was sitting there, you know, and he starts talking to me about home groups, and he says, now there's some people that meet on a Saturday night at a house meeting. It's an 8 o'clock meeting, and I'd recommend you stay away from there because there's nothing but weirdos, crazy people.
Sure.
So I made him a home group. Because I felt like I was comfortable. I went into this meeting, and there was a guy by the name of Arthur who was sitting in a queen rattan chair holding court. There were two gay women on the couch. There was a woman on the floor who was such a big overeater that she had to wear sheets because she was so big. And the guy that had brought me, he was on the same ship that I was a transvestite, and he had already gone upstairs and changed and came back down. So I felt really comfortable there. I mean, I thought if these people with all of their emotional hang-ups can stay sober, you know, maybe they'll make room for me. And the name of the group is the Beachcomber Spiritual Progress Traveling Group. And we're online. And there's about 300 of us worldwide. And we meet online every Wednesday. And about 6 years ago, we had a reunion up in Virginia Beach. And everybody who was in that room the first night is still sober. They had between 25 and 45 years of sobriety. Because that's how I learned how to get sober, is to rely on people. I couldn't do it alone. And back then, so we didn't have cell phones, we didn't have the internet. So your home group was your base. And the only reason you miss your home group meeting, they told me this, the only reason you miss this meeting is that you're either in a hospital, or you're working, or you're dead. And if I missed the meeting and I didn't tell them where I was, they'd be calling on the ship the next day saying, where are you? What are you, you know, and checking up on me. And gave me a sense of companionship. Mm-hmm. So when I got sober, I woke up sexually. I was just numb and dumb for years. I'm terrified of it, but I didn't want to be alone. So the two gay gals that were on the couch were going through a crisis, and they didn't know whether they were gay or not. Ellen and Hope. So the solution we came up with is that I would marry one and the other one would be a stepdaughter. So we lived together for 5 or 6 years. And it was very interesting. You know, every man's fantasy is to have two women. And I went, yeah, great. You know, after about 6 months of that crap, it just gets old.
Yeah. Yeah.
Gets old real fast. And then it's a soul-draining power struggle. You know? I was overseas on a cruise over in Europe. I was on an aircraft carrier. And it was my time to come home after being gone for 8 months. And I didn't want to come home because I knew I was waiting. So I was going to do what they call a cross deck. I could take somebody's place on the carrier that was relieving us, and he could go home if he had an emergency, and I would stay. This is how God works in my life. And I put in for it, and then the XO of the ship said he wanted to talk to me about this. So I went up to talk to him, and he says, I want to know what's going on with you. So I broke down and told him what was going on with me, because I'd been getting letters in the mail from everybody in my home group telling me what was going on. And I said, I just don't want to go home and face it, you know. And I said, I figure if I can cross deck and stay over here for another 6 or 8 months, I can get my shit together and I'll be all right. And the XO said, well, I've been Al-Anon for 20 years, and I don't think I'm going to let you do that. He was in Al-Anon for 20 years. And he says, you on home. So I came back to Virginia Beach. And almost drank over this. Almost drank because I was so confused and so hurt and so disgusted with myself. And just a lot of fear. And the best acronym I've ever heard for fear is future events appearing real. Mm. Because I'd live in my head thinking about what was going to happen tomorrow and try to go there and fix it today, and it wasn't tomorrow, if that makes any sense to anybody.
Oh, yeah.
And I had walked in the door of Alcoholics Anonymous with the same five fears everybody has walking in the door of Alcoholics Anonymous: fear of failure, fear of rejection, fear of commitment, fear of confrontation, and fear of abandonment. We all have them. And I didn't know that when I got here. I thought you guys were just staying sober. And I didn't know how to do it. I didn't know how to work the steps. I hadn't worked the steps. I worked step one. I was powerless over alcohol because the Navy said so. And my life was unmanageable because the Navy said so. So what I had figured, I was just going to stay sober until I could retire and get my check from the Navy and not drink. And then if I wanted to, I'm in the book, by the way. It's the businessman who decides to stay sober for his job, and then at the end of his job he moves to Florida. You know, and within 5 years he's dead from drinking. So I changed my home group, first thing I did, and I started to go to Al-Anon with my XO. He would make sure that I'd come to Al-Anon. And we had a meeting, a 12 and 12 meeting, and I'd come to the realization that with my wife and my daughter-in-law, they had just left, gone out of town together, and it was driving me crazy. So I knew they would come to this 12 and 12 meeting, so I figured, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to shoot them. That'll fix me. That'll help me. It's going to kill them. So I'm standing outside this meeting, and I'm greeting people. As they walk up, I made myself the greeter. And my sponsor walked by, and he said, "How's it going?" And I said, "Just great." And he walked about halfway down the hall, and he came back, and he says, "How are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I've decided to kill him." He said, "What?" And I pulled out a .38 out of my pocket. I had a .38. I went to meetings armed for about 5 years, heavily armed. But he talked me out of the weapon, and then he said, "Why don't you just go to a meeting, and we'll talk to it afterwards." And he was thinking, you know, if I'm sitting in an AA meeting, and they show up at the AA meeting, then everything's going to be crazy. So he said, "I got just the thing for you." He says, "Why don't you go in with your XO and go to the Al-Anon meeting?" So I started. That's how I got into Al-Anon. So I started to go to Al-Anon. And after the meeting, he took my bullets, but he gave me the gun back. So I was doing drive-bys all night long at their house looking for him. So it's firm in my head that I thought that the best thing I could do for all of us is to end it. I found out later that they were at a retreat, a week-long retreat down in Nags. They weren't even in town. I'm driving by their houses all night long. Just absolutely crazy. So I called this XO who was in Al-Anon, and he suggested I go to the Portsmouth Naval Hospital, the psychiatric ward, and talk to them. So I go to the Portsmouth Naval Hospital psychiatric ward, and I'm like sitting there with my foot up against the wall, and this psychiatrist comes in, he looks at me and nods at me and walks into his office and takes off his jacket and his hat and everything else and comes back out and leans right up against me in the wall and puts his foot on the wall. And he says, "What's up?" I said, "I'm going to kill him." He said, "You want to talk about it?" I said, "Well, it can't harm, you know, won't hurt anything, but I've already made my mind." So I went into his office. We started talking about it. He said, "There's a couple of Marines outside that don't like you having a gun in my office. So if you would take the weapon by the, and just hold it out the door, they'll take it and then they'll leave us alone." So I did that. And he says, "I think you're at risk. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to recommend that you stay here for 3 or 4 weeks." And by this time I was done. I was absolutely done. I said, "What do you want me to do?" He said, "I think you need some quiet time." And I didn't know what a quiet room was. You know, that's just the Navy's name for a... Yeah, they put me in a straitjacket and put me in this room. And I came apart, just literally came apart. And my thinking was insane. I'm in a straitjacket like this, and I'm looking out the little window, and I'm going, man, there's a lot of crazy people on there. So my AA sponsor found out I was there, and he went and asked the psychiatrist, asked me if I wanted to see him, and I said, yeah. And he came in, and he said, where are you in the steps? And I said, I don't know. You know, I don't know whether drinking it helped, I don't know whether drugging it helped, but I just got to have some relief. And he says, well, he said, it might be a good idea if you were to be convinced to turn your will and life over to the care of God as you understand him. I said, I don't understand what you just said. I have no clue. I don't have a God. I was raised Catholic. We don't have gods. Not for Boston. Anything that I believed in, anyway. I didn't have that religious thing, you know. I got thrown out of catechism so many times. I was about 8 years old, and the priest was standing up there talking about the creation of the earth. And he said, and the Lord spat out seven seas. And I said, son of a bitch, must have been eating something salty when he did that. He threw me out of that. So me and organized religion didn't do good. But Gene, that was my sponsor, he came to see me, and I got down on my knees in a rubber room with a straitjacket on, and I said, I am now willing to do whatever you want me to do. I don't care. You want me to jump 10 feet high? I'll attempt it. And I was willing to do whatever he said. And when he left, I slept for 16 hours. I hadn't slept in 3 or 4 days with this madness. So I slept for 16 hours. And that was, I was, I think, 5 or 6 years sober when that happened. And I got out of there and started seeing a psychiatrist, and then I started to see a counselor, because I had a lot of shit to deal with. You know, my mother married and buried 7 alcoholics, so my childhood wasn't all that hot. I didn't have a frame of reference for anything normal, anything normal. I had no clue what normal was. And I was affected all the time, because I didn't know. And people would say, oh, you're so nice. And I'd say, yeah, but you don't know me. So I started, I slept for 16 hours. And then when I got up, I started to go through these counseling classes and seeing a shrink every day. And I slowly came back around to where I was okay. And I got a divorce, naturally.
Sure.
And I let them, you know, I just said, go be and do whatever you want to be and do, because I can't help you anymore. It's killing me. And that's the first time I was honest with them. By the way, we're good friends today. We still are good friends today. After all, they've been sober. One's been sober longer than I have, and one's been sober a year less than I have. And we talk on a regular basis. You know, we laugh at some of this stuff now, but at the time it was pretty serious. So I threw myself into the steps. I never tried to work the steps. I just lived on 1, 2, and 3. I'm powerless over alcohol. My life's unmanageable, and God can have it if I let it go. The problem was, I didn't want to let anything go. So I struggled a lot in here, trying to figure out what you guys wanted me to do. And the steps were so foreign to me. When I got up to the 4th and 5th step, I took my family's inventory, not mine. Yeah. I took their inventory, and I thought they should be the ones kissing my ass, not the other way around. But most of the men were dead. I found out in sobriety that every male member of my immediate family, my father, died before they were 55 because they drank themselves to death and they had heart conditions that were unknown. So in 1998, I started to have heart attacks. And thank God for the advancements they made, you know. I had I had 5 heart attacks, 2 open heart surgeries. They tied my sternum up with stainless steel wire. Unbeknownst to me in the world, the acid in my blood ate the nickel core out of the stainless steel. So my whole sternum was open. And I had 26 pieces of steel rubbing against me, like having a piece of barbed wire down in your chest while you try to sleep. And I went to see the cutter, the guy that cut me, and he suggested that I live with it, with drugs. We can give you some good painkillers, you know. And I'm going, yeah, right. So I went to a meeting, and I talked about this in a meeting, and I said, I don't know what to do. You know, I don't want to get on that scene again with the drug. So a guy in a meeting, I don't even know who he is, said, call this guy, and he gave me his card. It was Orlando Ciclione. He was a plastic surgeon here in Orlando. And I went to see him, and he said, I got just a thing for you. He said, I've been working on it. He said, just tell my nurse your insurance information, and I'll take care of the rest. So I did that fast check-in Wednesday before the surgery on Friday. I went to the hospital Wednesday, did all the paperwork, and a woman says, oh, you have a copayment. $148,000 surgery. I got a copayment. It was $11. Navy, you know, retired military, we got good insurance. So he put this titanium plates. I have six of them in my chest. There's one under, one over, one under, one over, and they hook like this, all three of them. And they got a hole down the middle of them, and they put a Carter pin in and spread it. That's what's holding me together. So if I ever have surgery, they just split the skin, straighten out the Carter pin, pop them out, and I can do whatever you want. I get a X-ray every year when I get my physical, and my doctor likes to scratch my name out of it and hang it on a wall so all the nurses can see it, because it's kind of interesting. But I have had all my needs met in Alcoholics Anonymous if I just let go. The sad part about it is I didn't know what was being offered here when I got here. You know, I looked around and I thought, this is going to be boring. You know, all they want to do is talk about alcohol. And how not to drink it, and drugs, and how not to do that stuff, and yada, 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 you know. And I said, I don't want to do that. I want to party. And I think I had maybe 5 years of bobs in and out, in and out, in and out. And I got finally got sober, finally came in and made a commitment. And I said, I'm going to try this. And this was before I hit my mark of retiring. In 1977, I think I retired in 85, 20 years. But once I surrendered to Alcoholics Anonymous and I started to do the work, I started to realize how screwed up I really am. Because if you could look at me and say, man, you're a waste. Your whole life is just going from one tragedy or one incident to another and another and another, and you never take time to clean them up. You never take time to do this work and be spiritually, mentally, and physically fit in the same breath, is what my sponsor said. That's what you're trying to do. Physically, mentally, spiritually fit in the same breath. And I went, no, I didn't give it that much thought. And I had a problem with the God as you understand him. My God today doesn't have a deity. I don't believe that if you don't believe my way, you're not going to go to heaven. I think heaven is what you make of it here. And I'm more of a spiritualist than I am a Christian. You know, I look at nature, I look at people. My first outside step into the world of spirituality was I joined the Edgar Cayce Foundation. I've been a card-carrying member for a long time now. I still am. And they believe that in nature, they believe in communication with people. They believe that there's an answer. All you have to do is look for it. And when my first year of tenure with Edgar Cayce, I had no feeling in my lower legs. Found out it was a ruptured disc, but they could stick a pin in my leg all the way to the bone, and I wouldn't feel it. I wouldn't flinch. So I went to see the doctors, and they told me, they diagnosed me with MS, of the spine. And they said, eventually you're going to have to go to a cane, and then you're going to have to go to a walker, and then you're going to be in a wheelchair. And you'll be in a wheelchair for the rest of your life. So I go to Edgar Cayce, and I go, if that's what you believe, that's what's going to happen. And I said, what are you talking about? said, well, if you think that the doctors have the power to dictate your future, they do. But if you think that God is the ultimate source, let's see what we can do. I know 1,050 ways to cook carrots because I had to have mega doses of beta carotene. I didn't miss a meal without carrots. You know, you can make carrot pancakes. Did you know that? And I ate tons of carrots, and I took tons of supplements, tons of them, with the belief that God is the ultimate authority here. Not my doctor, not my mom, not my boss. God is the ultimate authority. And I've never gone to a cane, and I still have, every 6 weeks, I have a numbness in my legs where you can stick a needle all the way in, and I can't feel it. But it doesn't bother me. You know, it just doesn't bother me anymore because I'm functional with it. I just have to be careful that I don't hit something and cut my leg. But that's what I believe. That's what I believe that Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me this, has told me that there is a different way of life. You do not have to be shackled to alcohol. You do not have to be shackled to the drugs. You do not have to be shackled to people. God is the ultimate authority here. And I learned how to do an inventory, an honest inventory, where I didn't take your inventory, I took mine. And I found out about all my fears and all my sins, you know. And I learned that the original terminology for a sin, it's an archery term. It means missing the mark. And I missed the mark a lot, getting sober. But I learned that if I did the work and I cleaned up my own act, then I would attract people into my life like life attracts life. So who wants to be with somebody who's angry all the time, crazy all the time, mean all the time, looking to see what I could get all the time? You know, that's who I was attracting in my life. And I'm saying, why am I doing this? You know, because like attracts like. So I had to learn a whole new way of living. I didn't have any idea of how to live. What I learned in here is a lifestyle. This is my lifestyle. This is what I do. I come to meetings, and I help other alcoholics. And I get up in the morning and ask God to keep me clean and sober. And the last thing I'll do tonight before I go to bed is say thank you, because I haven't had to take a drink today. And I know that I don't know if I would come back after if I drank again, but who wants to find out? I mean, there's no need anymore. The game's over. It's done. And the people that are new here are coming back. You're screwed. I mean, just, you can't raise your hand and say, I'm an alcoholic, and then negate that later on down the road. You know, once you admit you're an alcoholic, you're done. You know, you got three choices. You're either going to get locked up, you're going to get covered up, or you're going to get sobered up. And if you've been here for any length of time, you've seen the ones that have gotten covered up. And I don't want to go that way. And it's not necessary if I do a few simple things. That's what the book says. If I do a few simple things, you know, and open my heart to life, instead of being alone, instead of being crazy, instead of being looking for what I could get rather than what I can give, I know more people today than I've ever known in my life. You know, I got people calling me. I had these heart attacks. I didn't think I mattered. You know, and the doctor told me that he had to shut the ICU down because there were like 300 people showing up because so much is related to our past. I was laying in bed after open heart surgery and my kidneys were shutting down, and I puffed up like the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. I mean, I was just bloated. And the doctor came over, and he said, I said, what's wrong? And he says, well, you're retaining fluids. And I said, what do I got to do? He said, you got to pee. And I said, where's the bathroom? He said, you have a catheter in you. I said, what's that? Nobody ever told me what a catheter was. He said, that's a tube we put in you so you can pee. And I said, oh, okay. What had happened was, psychologically, one of my fathers, when I was growing up, if I wet the bed, he would whip my ass bloody for wetting the bed. So flash forward a couple of years, you know, years forward, I'm laying here in bed holding till I can get out of bed and go to the bathroom. So I started to pee, and I came out of it all right. But I didn't know. You know, you don't know what you don't know. It still holds true today. It's still an adventure. So five heart attacks, open heart surgery. How many wives have I had? Counting to two, I think there's five. If not, yeah, I mean, if not married, but I mean, you live together long enough and it's just like being married. But learning how to have a, if there is such a thing, I still don't know. If I can have a sane, sensible relationship with a woman, I just don't know. Because I'm whacked in that area. I'm just crazy. I want what I want when I want it. And they want what they want when they want it. You know? So I don't butt heads anymore. I put that part of my life away for a while until I can figure out who I am, what I am. I learned a long time ago that if you do something for me that I should do for myself, you're hurting me. You're absolutely hurting me. There are certain things that I am required to do on a daily basis that if I don't do them, it catches up fast. Like I start to feel squirrely if I don't go to a meeting for 3 days. I don't know about anybody else what your agenda is or how soon you got to be here or how long you got to be here. But I can tell I start getting irritable driving. You know, third day from no meeting. So I make it a point to come back here and get back in the flow of things, you know, because when I'm happy here, I'm happy out there. Now, if I can live in here with you guys and listen to all the stories that you tell me, and I think today it's even worse for the new people because you guys will hit bottom a lot quicker than I did because there's a lot of stylish shit out there. You know, I mean, they make raspberry vodka now. I mean, jeez. You know, I'm going, Dad, I wonder what that tastes like. I'll tell you about my head, too. I've got, when I got here, I had about 10 or 12 voices in my head, and none of them agreed. It was like in a station wagon full of kids, and you and the driver, and they all wanted to go somewhere you didn't want to go. And I had these personalities. And you know you got it when you tell yourself to shut up. Why don't you just shut up? Who are you talking to? So I'm very happy to report that I have them down to four now. I got four personalities. I have a young boy that needs to be nurtured and played with and have fun. I have an adolescent that wants to act out all the time. I have an adult that pays the bills. And then I have the ism. And the ism is the one I used to have the hardest time with. You know, you could sleep 20 hours and wake up and your head will tell you you're tired. Go back to sleep. After, you know, being in bed all day. And the ism will tell you, don't take a chance, don't do this, don't do that, because you don't know what the results are going to be. I always try to figure out what the results were before I risked anything. And I learned how to deal with my ism personality in my head. I just ask it one question over and over, and it shuts up. And the question is, what is your source of information? What are you basing this decision on? And usually it's some fear. You know, fear of failure, fear of rejection, whatever. It has that fear that comes back in, and that ism voice takes over and says, you know, let's do something we're not supposed to do. And that's the one I battle the most. The rest of them are all just happy. When I get that ism thing going, I'm being selfish and self-centered. I want it my way. I don't want to talk to you. I don't want to come to a meeting. I don't want to do anything other than what this thing tells me to do. And it's deadly. It is really, really deadly. So after 37 years of sobriety, I'm amazed that I keep coming here. I've seen a lot of people leave here and not come back. And that's sad. The attrition rate is horrible in here. I'm going to tell you about my buddy and what keeps me, really keeps me sober. And then I'm going to read something for you, and then I'm going to shut up. But I had a good friend, his name was Kevin, and he had 17 years of sobriety, and he got over on the spiritual side of life, and rather than talking AA, he was preaching in here, pulling people around and reading from the Bible and the big book and yada, yada, yada. If that's your gig, it's fine. But he had isolated himself to the point where nobody wanted to be around. He was taking Oxycontin for, he had hurt his spine somewhere, and he was in a lot of pain, so they gave him Oxycontin for it. And then he got pissed off because nobody would talk to him because he pushed everybody away. So he went home and got a bottle of rum and figured he would drink. And that would take care of it after 17 years of sobriety. And he died in his apartment. And nobody, they didn't find him for 3 weeks. And the smell from the apartment, the neighbors called, and the police came, and they opened the door, and Kevin had two Rottweilers who were hungry. And they closed the door and then sent a hazmat team in to put the dogs down and took what was left of him and brought him out. And that's how he passed away after 17 years of sobriety. And what I've discovered is that I, being 37 years sober, have a daily reprieve contingent upon the maintenance of a spiritual condition, just a spiritual condition. And I have no conflict with what you want to believe is a higher power, none whatsoever. Just ask that you don't believe that alcohol can be your higher power. Something else, whether, you know, whatever. Whatever you want to be your higher power, as long as it's not you, that's fine. And I think of Kevin a lot, you know. Sometimes I think responsibility, you know, maybe I should have called him, maybe I should have gone, yada, yada. But I even got tired of hearing his crap, and I've known him for a long time. I had known him a long time. So when he passed away, it was a shock to me. And I thought, what a way to go. What a way to go. I don't want to do that. I don't want to be alone when I die. I want to be with my friends. The only way I can be with my friends is not drink, because you all are my friends. You all are my family now. My mom passed last year. I've got a sister that's selling Oxycontin on the street. She's a prison term waiting to happen. I got another sister who had 20 years sobriety. She's back drinking. She's put on 90 pounds in a year. Huge. Her heart's not going to take it. She's going to go. You know, ad infinitum to all of it. I mean, we are very, I come from a very dysfunctional family, so you know I'm dysfunctional. And I have to learn a way to live. I have to learn in here, through trial and error, how to live without drinking. And the very first thing that comes into my head is, you know, God, please help me stay sober today. Every morning when I wake up, within 5 minutes of consciousness, I say that so that I can get it from here to here, from my head to my heart. You know, God, please help me stay sober today. And it's a reminder about what's going on. I don't have a life unless I'm sober. I don't. So make this your lifestyle. If you're new here, come to a lot of meetings. They have a lot of functions besides meetings. You know, there's a lot of different groups out there that do different things, and make it a lifestyle. And find where you're comfortable here. If you're sitting in this room tonight and you're not drinking, you're either an Al-Anon or you're an alcoholic. Normal people don't come here on a Saturday night. You know, they just don't. I mean, I'm about three centers, you know, three paces away from center, and that's where I like to live. I like to live on that outside edge. And that's why I love Alcoholics Anonymous, is because none of us are wrapped tight. None of us. And the only thing that I got going for me is that I ask God to keep me clean and sober on a daily basis. My sobriety is contingent upon the maintenance of a spiritual condition. Now, I'm going to read this and then I'm going to shut up. I got this a long time ago, old paper. I got my little girly glasses. This piece of paper says, in creation of a better world, you must believe in yourself at all times. You must never lose faith that you are capable of doing anything in life you choose to do. And you must always choose the highest. It is not enough for you to choose that you must achieve excellence, for you must believe in yourself enough to accomplish that which others cannot accomplish. To believe in yourself, you must have courage that exceeds the need for the consideration of courage. It must be a natural part of your life that avoids any need for decision-making based on whether you have the courage to do that, which you must. This must be a belief beyond personal questioning, beyond personal doubt, to a point when it can no longer be considered courage, but as a way of life. This shall be so, for you will believe in yourself. You must have character that is beyond criticism and a permanent part of yourself. It is not imagined or pretended. Every moment of your life must be naturally conducted with pride and dignity that cannot be confused with arrogance, but recognized with respect. Your character must always contain compassion and concern for others. This concern will be genuine, for you will never lose sight of your background in trying to understand those you have difficulty in identifying with, for they are the majority of the world and the ones that need the help the most. You must believe in yourself that your character never bends, never compromises, and is consistent. You must believe in your intellect that no task is beyond your ability to succeed. Your intellect is a gift that you shall not waste, and you shall use it to your greatest capacity. You must have the patience and tolerance to realize that others will not always agree with or understand you, but rather than find fault, you shall try harder to reach them, for it shall become your responsibility to serve them. This is your calling. You cannot question it, and you must accept it. Thank you.